Where's the Board of Fisheries?
Gotta take more time coming.
Okay.
Come on, Jake.
I'd like to call the House Resource Committee meeting to order. It's 8:36, April 2nd. Today we're holding a hearing on House Bill 288, which is an act relating to taking a fish and game for subsistence and personal use. Members present are myself, Chairman Representative Herman, Representative Cato, Representative Wallace, Representative Schultz, Representative Thompson, and Representative Jenkins. And we have as guests today Representative Fuller and Representative Randy Phillips. If you would like to join us at the table, Representative Phillips, you may do so. The meeting is being teleconferenced on a listen-only basis statewide. The meeting today is to have before the Resources Committee the attorneys in the Madison case, as well as the attorney who is an intervener in the case. And we'll have Don Mitchell explain what that is when he's testifying before us. Before we get into discussion, I would like to announce the future hearings or teleconferences on the bill. On Thursday, April 4th, from 8:30 till noon, we'll have public testimony, statewide public participation teleconference. And we'll recess briefly to make a quorum on the floor at 10 o'clock. On Monday, April 8th, from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m., we'll have public testimony, statewide public participation teleconference. On Tuesday, April 9th, from 8:30 to 10, there will be presentations by the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Law. This will be a statewide listen-in teleconference available until 9:30. The Resources Committee did hear briefly from Fish and Game and the Department of Law on this bill, and it will be hearing from them again. For more information, you can obtain that from my office through the weekly committee schedule. We have before you the packets that my staff has provided, and it's got the index in here, and all the information is in there. I didn't want them to be that big, but they're going to be growing too. For the record, I'd like to note the presence of Representative Pierce. Today I'd like to take questions from the committee to the attorneys first, the committee members first, and then the guests will have a chance to question depending on the time. With that, I'd like to call Chuck Robinson to testify before us. If you could explain the case and the interpretation of the case. And also, we have Marty Friedman online in Homer, and if he could, once Chuck is done, then if Marty has something to add, I'll ask Marty to respond.
All these mics working, or just one?
Only need one.
Do I have to push this or anything to talk?
No.
My name is Chuck Robinson. I live at 35401 Kenai Spur Highway, Soldotna, Alaska. I am an attorney, commercial fisherman, and concerned Alaskan citizen. I am one of two prevailing co-counsels in the case of Madison versus the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I've been invited to speak before this committee this morning concerning the implications of the Madison case as it relates to subsistence use of fish in particular and game in general. The committee members should have before them a document which myself and Mr. Friedman have prepared called Subsistence After Madison. And I would urge you to read that at some point in time during the deliberations on House Bill 288. The Madison case was brought by several Kenai Peninsula residents in 1981 to seek a declaration from the Alaska Supreme Court as to whether or not a set of subsistence regulations established by the Board of Fisheries at its March 1981 meeting were in fact valid. Plaintiffs in that case believed that the set of regulations created by the board were inconsistent with the intent and the spirit of the current subsistence law. The court apparently agreed with plaintiffs and on February 22nd of this year ruled in favor of Madison and other subsistence fishermen from the Kenai Peninsula. In order to really understand the Madison case, I think that this committee must have some overview of the facts which led up to this decision. The facts are rather complex in that they spanned a substantial period of time, but I will try to capsulize as best as I can what those facts were. Since 1972, when Governor Bill Egan was head of the executive branch of the state, the Department of Fish and Game developed a policy on subsistence use of fish and game in the state. That policy said that in times of resource shortages, subsistence use by Alaska residents would have the highest priority use over other beneficial uses. Despite the fact that the policy was established by the Egan administration, the Board of Fisheries pretty much ignored that policy and for several years managed fish in such a way that in times of resource shortages, subsistence did not have a priority use. The policy was also created at a time when the Constitution of Alaska was amended, particularly Article 8, Section 15, which created commercial limited entry fisheries in the state. It also was established approximately a year after the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act was enacted by Congress. The policy also came about at a time when Alaska was experiencing social and economic development sort of in its infancy stages as a result of the Alaska oil pipeline. By 1977, Alaska had experienced a substantial growth in population, particularly in the Anchorage Bowl area. And as a result of pressures from sport fishing interest groups in the Anchorage area, the Board of Fisheries developed what was known as the Upper Cook Inlet Salmon Management Plan. This management plan was designed to allocate specific salmon stocks between commercial and recreational uses in Cook Inlet. The plan did not address subsistence uses at all. Again, despite the fact that there was a policy on record from the Egan administration which said that subsistence should have the highest priority use. This management plan essentially allocated fish stocks based on what salmon stocks were present in the inlet during particular times in the year. The plan allocated to the recreational fishery all salmon stocks present in Upper Cook Inlet prior to June 30 and all salmon stocks destined to spawn on the Kenai Peninsula after August 15th. Between the time of July 1st and August 15th, stocks of salmon were allocated on a priority basis to commercial use. The subsistence fishery never received any specific allocated stocks, according to the plan. The fish that were allocated to recreational fisheries in Cook Inlet were comprised mainly of early-run Chinook salmon, which in Cook Inlet comprised the majority of king salmon in the region, and fall coho salmon present in Cook Inlet after August 15th. The commercial fishery was pretty much allocated red, pink, and chum salmon found between July 1st and August 15th. About a year after this management plan was established by the Board of Fisheries, the legislature passed the current subsistence law. It became effective in October of 1978. In less than 2 months after the effective date of the current subsistence law, the Board of Fisheries eliminated all subsistence fishing for salmon on the eastern shore of Cook Inlet. Prior to 1978, the Board had eliminated subsistence fishing in the Homer area. The Homer subsistence fishermen in 1977 went to Superior Court to seek an injunction against the Board of Fisheries for its regulation that essentially abolished this Homer subsistence fishery. The Superior Court agreed with the Homer subsistence fishermen, the lead plaintiff in the case being Louis Jolson, and reestablished by permanent injunction the Homer subsistence fishery. The board in 1978 opened king salmon fishing on stocks headed for the Susitna River drainage system to recreational use and denied any access or use of those stocks to either commercial or subsistence use. In 1979, residents from the village of Tyonic, which is located on the northwest shore of Cook Inlet, small Indian village, made a proposal to the Board of Fisheries requesting that they be allowed to have a subsistence king salmon fishery on Susitna River drainage king salmon. The Board denied this request. The Tyonic residents went to Superior Court, requested the court to open and mandate a subsistence fishery in the Tyonic region on the basis that if there were enough stocks to allow a recreational harvest on those fish, then there should be a subsistence harvest in conjunction and compliance with the current subsistence law. Judge Carlson, who was the judge in the case, agreed with the Tyonic residents and forced the board, through judicial decree, to open a subsistence fishery in Tyonic. After the board was forced to open the Tyonic fishery, it became pretty clear to them that some form of subsistence fishery would have to be allowed in Cook Inlet, despite these priorities that had been delegated to recreational use in the Cook Inlet management plan. So in 1980, the board opened the subsistence fishing for kings in Tyonic and also opened up subsistence fishing on the eastern shore of Cook Inlet and in Homer. However, the east side Cook Inlet subsistence fishery in 1980 was placed in an area known as the Otter Creek area, which was heavily rock-strewn, extremely muddy, and very difficult access to this area in order to fish. As a result of this action, another group of litigants, primarily from the Central Peninsula, brought another court case against the Board of Fisheries. Eastern Shore of Cook Inlet near North Kenai, that was more accessible to the people who desired to go subsistence fishing. Then, in 1981, the Supreme Court invalidated the 1977 management plan, and the board was forced to create a new management plan. At the same time, the board was being requested by federal agencies as well as the AFN to bring their regulations in compliance with the intent and the spirit of the subsistence law. An argument was put forth by the Assistant Attorney General representing the board at the time and the Alaska Federation of Natives representative that the words customary and traditional, as found in the current subsistence law, meant that only rural residents in Alaska were entitled to subsistence fishing. Much objection was made on the part of traditional subsistence fishermen in the Cook Inlet area. They did not agree that their fishery was no longer a subsistence fishery, that it was as much a customary and traditional fishery as any other subsistence fishery was in the state, and that this distinction that was made by the Attorney General's office and the AFN between subsistence use and personal use was not a real and valid substantial distinction between the two types of activities, if there is any distinction between those activities. Nonetheless, the Board of Fisheries, in trying to seek two goals, one, to comply with the subsistence law in the way in which it interpreted the law, and to preserve these priority fisheries that it had created in its new 1981 management plan, took the position espoused by the Attorney General and AFN that customary and traditional uses in Alaska means or meant that only rural Alaskans would be allowed to subsistence fish. As a result of that interpretation, a set of regulations were adopted. Those regulations, in effect, excluded from the subsistence fishery in Cook Inlet the majority of participants. For instance, Gene Madison and Louis Jolson, the lead plaintiffs in the Madison case, are people who have subsistence fished in the Kenai Peninsula area since the mid-1940s. Other people, Lucy Casey, also a native plaintiff in the Madison case, born and raised in the Kenai area, been subsistence fishing since 1935. Were completely excluded from subsistence use of fish in Cook Inlet. Only the residents of Tyonic, Port Graham, and English Bay were considered rural under the board's definition of customary and traditional, and only those residents were allowed to subsistence fish. The board completely ignored other communities in Cook Inlet that could have classified as rural, such as Clam Gulch, with a total population of 100 people, Nanilchik, with a total population of 200 people, other scattered and isolated communities, such as Chinitna Bay, which has an annual population of 4 people. These people were no longer able to subsistence fish because these areas had been declared by the Board of Fisheries to be urban in characteristic. So Madison and Jolson took their plea to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court agreed that the board had given an inconsistent interpretation to the current subsistence law, that law was not intended to exclude urban residents from subsistence fishing, nor rural residents from subsistence fishing. Now, since the Madison's decision, there has been a great degree of debate and confusion about the current subsistence law, which has led Governor Sheffield to introduce House Bill 288. However, the opinion is fairly simple, fairly clear, and it shouldn't take too much to understand the implications of the decision. The Supreme Court merely set down the parameters of the current subsistence law. It did not create a circumstance which would allow for runaway subsistence use of either fish or game. The opinion was not intended to mean that before subsistence uses could be limited, sport and commercial fishing must be eliminated. The main concerns that I have heard from the governor's administration concerning the Madison case and its relations to subsistence law is twofold. One, that the Madison decision now places the current subsistence law in a non-compliant state with ANILCA, and that subsistence uses may not be limited or regulated until such time that sports and commercial fisheries are eliminated. Let's address the ANILCA question first. The argument that was put forth by the intervener, AFN, in the Madison case was that the federal law requires that subsistence use of fish and game be limited solely to rural Alaskans. They also maintained that as an alternative to subsistence uses, urban residents should have personal use, since that's what they were engaged in prior to 1978, when the pre-78 subsistence law read that subsistence fishing was the taking of fish for personal use, not for barter or sale. The Supreme Court rejected that argument because it said that the legislature in 1978 did not intend for subsistence uses to be limited to merely rural Alaskans. It was fairly clear from the committee record on the debates and discussion about that law that urban residents too should be able to participate in customary and traditional uses of fish and game. The bill's floor leader, Representative Nels Anderson, made that very clear, and Representative Parr from Fairbanks made that very clear in the debates. In 1982, Undersecretary of the Department of Interior Bill Horn gave a presentation to the joint boards of Fish and Game concerning what was necessary on the part of these boards in the fashioning of their regulations to be in compliance with the Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act, ANILCA. At that time, Mr. Horn stated very clearly that the federal government would only require the bare minimum on the part of the state to be in compliance with ANILCA, and that there were two options in which the boards could take in order to meet that compliance. The board could either create a tier one approach to subsistence uses, whereby only rural residents would be able to fish and hunt for subsistence purposes, or a tier two approach to subsistence uses, whereby both rural and urban residents would be able to participate in subsistence uses, and at such time that the resources were so low that only subsistence uses were permitted on these resources, and there was not enough resource to satisfy subsistence use needs, Then distinctions could be made between rural and urban residents based on customary dependency on the resource, local residents, and alternate availability of resources. Mr. Horn made it clear that if the board took either one of those approaches, that Secretary Watt would immediately forward a letter to the then Governor Hammond and declare that the state was in compliance with ANILCA. The Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game opted for the one-tier approach. The Supreme Court reviewed the one-tier approach and declared it void by saying the current subsistence law was intended to create a two-tier approach to ANILCA, thereby being in compliance with ANILCA laws. The other confusion is, as I've heard stated by Commissioner Collinsworth and Assistant Attorney General Spangler, that subsistence uses cannot be limited until such time that sports and commercial fishing is eliminated. That is a misrepresentation of the Madison opinion. The Madison opinion made it very clear that there is a distinction between uses and users. And in regard to the limitation of eligibility into the fishery, which is the primary issue that the court was dealing with, it was dealing with the questions of users. So, the issue is, under current subsistence law, can you limit subsistence users before you eliminate commercial or sports fishing? The Supreme Court says that before you can move from the Tier 1, which is the general subsistence approach under our law, meaning any Alaskan resident can qualify for a subsistence permit to fish or hunt, before you can narrow that class down to a preferred subsistence user group, which would be those people who are customarily dependent on the resource, live closest to the resource, and have no other alternate resources to use in terms of fishing game. Before you can make that leap, you must find two things. First, you must find that the stocks in question are in jeopardy, and that there's a need to restrict the take in order to maintain the sustained yield of the resource. And two, that by eliminating commercial and sport use on those stocks, you still cannot assure that there will be a maintenance of those stocks on a sustainable basis. Only at that point in time, and that's based on a factual determination, can the class of subsistence users be narrowed down to what we call the preferred subsistence user group? But at any time, even at that point and prior to that point, the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game have numerous powers to limit the take of fishing game for subsistence uses. The Supreme Court opinion did not in any way upset or overturn the board's powers to set bag limits, establish quotas, create open and closed seasons, time, area, method and means of gear. None of those things were disturbed by the Madison case. I mean, if you just think about it, it's sort of common sense. And the legislature is charged with management of our natural renewable resources for conservation, utilization, and development of those resources. In order to manage those resources, the issues that must be addressed is, what are the purposes for which these resources are put? If the purpose, for instance, in fisheries, is to put salmon utilization for commercial use, if that's the issue, and the state of Alaska wants to compete in a world market on a substantial level, then that utilization is going to have to be somewhat substantial. You're going to have to make large numbers of salmon resources available in order to stay within the top five of the United States fishing communities.
Mr. Robinson, could you wind down your testimony?
Yes.
And then I'd like to hear from Marty Freeman if he has anything to add to that. And then I'd like to have the committee ask questions of the witness.
All right.
So we can go on to the next one.
On the same line, if the purpose for the use of the fish is subsistence use, the question is how much is needed to take care of subsistence needs? Do you need 90% of the salmon resources to take care of subsistence needs, where you may need that much to take care of a commercial need if you want to compete in an international market? So the Board of Fisheries is not limited in any way to say to any demand, we would like to have X number of fish. They have to determine whether that number is reasonable and then decide how to limit its use of subsistence fish or game. And that's about all I have to say at this point.
Okay. Could you please state it? At this time, Mr. Freedman, if you could come online and give us any additional comments that you have to Mr. Chuck Robinson's testimony, and then we'll take questions from the committee to both Mr. Robinson and yourself.
My name is Martin Freedman, Box 387, Homer, Alaska. I've been involved in subsistence litigation since 1976, and with the general commercial fisheries issue since about that time also. I have very little to add to what Chuck has laid out for you. He's basically run through the history of subsistence fishery in the Cook Inlet area. There are some points that I could raise, but I'm not going to do that for time limitations. I will point out one thing. I am in agreement with Chuck on this, on the questions that are really before this committee and before the our state government, really. The misperceptions that I've perceived in the press as a result of statements made by, I assume it's coming from the Sheffield administration regarding the subsistence law, has created a lot of confusion. I think that what this committee has to do and what the consideration of the governor's proposed bill demands is that no action essentially be taken. The state of Alaska has in fact been acting illegally since 1978. I think that we should at least give the Board of Fisheries an opportunity to act within the parameters of the law that the Supreme Court has set it out. I believe, and I think I assume that the committee members have copies of Bill Horn's testimony. They also should have some letters of opinion from the Attorney General's office regarding the first and second tier subsistence priority, which satisfies ANILCA. I'm sure that if the administration desires to sabotage or raise serious questions about compliance with ANILCA, they can do that. But from everything that indicated to the state, from the federal government regarding compliance with ANILCA, the second-tier approach that the Madison Supreme Court decision set out should satisfy any concern. Secondly, regarding the power of the Board of Fish to regulate subsistence uses prior to any priority having been placed in effect, I'll refer this, and again, this raises some confusion in my mind, I'll refer the committee members to a February 25th, 1983 State of Alaska Memorandum to Governor Bill Sheffield from Norman C. Gorsuch. And on page 12 of that opinion, it states here, there are outlining certain misperceptions. And one of the misperceptions they were dealing with was that subsistence harvest may not be regulated without triggering priority. What they say there is just, and this is a quote on page 12 of that opinion, just as with other uses, subsistence harvest can be regulated by specified areas, openings, and other management measures. And they do indicate that you do not have to get into your second-tier approach before you can regulate subsistence uses. I think it's pretty clear from reading the subsistence law and from reading the general authority of the Department of Fish and Game and the Board of Fisheries under Alaska Statute 1605-251, that there was nothing, absolutely nothing, in the subsistence law that was meant to take away the power of the Board of Fish to regulate subsistence uses. That power still is in the law. There's a subsistence division that has yet be given the force of the subsistence law and have the Board of Fishers rely on their documentation, data, indexing, cataloging subsistence uses in the state. So my general statement, and accepting basically what Chuck has outlined to you, is that there should be nothing done in adopting any new law. I think the subsistence law is a pretty simple, clear statement of what the legislature intended when they adopted it. That there is the mechanisms, the means, and the tools to adopt regulations consistent with the subsistence law without any of the scare scenarios or the catastrophic scenarios that have been communicated to the general public regarding what will happen now. All of those have been, particularly in the Southern District fishery, the evidence indicates just the contrary. The Southern District subsistence fishery in Cook Inlet has been open by judicial decree since 1977. It has been open to all Alaskans as users. The use has been identified by year, time, location, bag limit, and sort of a general quota. There has been no tremendous influx of people. There's been no harm to the commercial or sports uses in the Southern District as a result of that. So generally, to sort of sum up and give you an opportunity to ask questions that we have, I think that nothing should be done. State of Alaska should make a strong attempt to act within the law regarding the subsistence. Now, especially when there has not been an opportunity for actual action
within the law. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony, Marty. Now I'm going to go to questions of the committee. I have a question of you, Mr. Robinson. What did you say earlier about the state having to comply with ANILCA at the bare minimum? Could you explain further on that?
Usually in circumstances where federal legislation touches upon the state's authorities to manage a particular area, in this particular case fish and game on federal lands, the law is generally to require some minimal standards that the state must meet in order to come in compliance with whatever the federal request may be. With regard to ANILCA, the management of by the state of fish and game resources on state land, on federal lands, the Department of Interior made it really clear and very clear to the Boards of Game and Fish that the federal government was only seeking the very minimal requirements the state must meet in order to comply with ANILCA. And as Mr. Horn pointed out at that time, a two-tier approach, in other words, one tier of general subsistence users and a second tier of preferred subsistence users, would, in the federal government's opinion, bring the state into requirements of ANILCA. Our Supreme Court in Madison has taken that very approach, saying that the law in 1978 was intended to be a two-tier subsistence use approach. And I think that makes it very clear that ANILCA is already being complied with under the law. However, the Board of Fisheries has yet to adopt regulations that would bring its regulations into compliance with state law on subsistence.
Thank you. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Robinson, you made a statement earlier that I'd like to make sure I have clear in my mind. Would you please tell me what the word misrepresentation means to you?
Well, I think that what is happening here is that there is an approach spearheaded primarily by the Attorney General's office to try to get the legislature to do what the court refused to do.
Okay. Could you please define the term misrepresentation?
Well, misrepresentation to me is it's the statement made to a hearer that does not present the true picture of what in fact is.
Does that term imply intent on your part?
Well, I can't say whether or not the misrepresentation at this point is willful or it's just as a result of ignorance. I have no way of knowing. I just know that comments that have been made to the general uninformed public about the implications of Madison completely misrepresent the intent of the case.
In your opinion?
Yes.
Misrepresentation, then, is a matter of one person's opinion versus another's.
Well, until I guess some third entity decides which way it goes, but I mean, there are, in fact, things that are represented to be that are not, in fact, true.
I just, if I may, Madam Chairman, I thought I understood you to say that you thought Commissioner Collingsworth was misrepresenting Madison's opinion.
Yes, because all I can say is that Mr. Collingsworth has written a memorandum that states in the memorandum that subsistence use cannot be limited until such time that sports and commercial fishing is eliminated. The word use is a misrepresentation of what Madison said. What Madison said is that you can't limit subsistence users until two things happen. Harm to the resource is apparent, and you can't assure the maintenance of the stocks on a sustainable basis, even if you eliminate sport and commercial fishing. Then you can set these priorities among subsistence users. But at any time, before that or after that, subsistence use, that is, the use of the fish itself, can be limited by bag limits, quotas, time, area, and that sort of thing. And that is the misrepresentation.
In your mind.
For the record, I'd like to note the presence of Representative Gall. And are there further questions of Representative Thompson?
Mr. Robinson, in your mind, is this misrepresentation the cause or the result of HB 288?
In my opinion, it is the cause of the introduction of HB 288. I think that the interpretations given to the governor's administration by the Attorney General's office and others about subsistence uses has caused this legislation to be introduced. And I'm here hopefully to go on record to help clear up some of this misunderstanding and confusion about what Madison means. And we have to remember to keep uses and users distinct in the discussion. And I think if we can do that, then we can clear up some of this misunderstanding.
Are there further questions from committee members?
Yes, I have a question.
Representative Schultz.
Okay. I was just wondering to Chuck, does this bill 288 that we have before us, do you see this as providing any kind of a permanent solution to the problem?
I don't know that it would. I can see a couple of problems right off the bat if this legislation is passed. First, I see some real serious constitutional problems with it in light of a couple of specific Alaska Constitution provisions. One is Article 8, Section 15, which clearly says that there shall be no exclusive or special privilege in fisheries except for commercial fisheries and aquaculture. So in order to establish a rule eligibility into a fishery, smacks contrary to that prohibition against special privileges. I mean, if the only basis for entry into a fishery is based on residence, I think that this law would run into some real serious constitutional problems. The second thing is that under Article 8, Section 17 of the Constitution, that requires that there be uniform application of laws concerning the use and disposal of natural resources in Alaska among people who are similarly situated. I think that if our Supreme Court were to view HB 288 passed in its present form and conform and look at the facts of the plaintiffs in the Madison case, they would say that, look, the people in the Madison case have a customary, traditional use of fish in the Cook Inlet area for subsistence purposes. They're similarly situated to someone in Tyonek, Pork Ram, English Bay, or out west in western Alaska in a rural community. Therefore, you can't provide this differential treatment to these people based on residency, that since they're similarly situated, they too would have to be treated equally, and you could not limit it to rural residents. The other thing is how is rural defined? I mean, I've heard that the board would like to go back to do what it's done since 1981. Well, if that's the case, then that means that communities like Clam Gulch with 100 people in it would be considered urban. That doesn't make any sense to me. So if rural is not defined, then how, and if you leave it to the Board of Fisheries to define rural, given their proclivities of definitions and interpretations of law over the last 7 or 8 years, I'm afraid that we'll be back in court again, and the court is going to come up with some rural definition that perhaps even the legislature is not going to like. So I think that this bill does not solve any problems, if there are any problems, to be resolved.
Are there further questions of the committee members? Representative Schultz?
That was my next question. I was just going to follow up on the rural definition. And you mentioned earlier in your testimony, I believe you made comment that it was an attorney for AFN that advocated the board's limit to rural to, and there were several communities that you, Tyonic was one, Port Graham.
Tyonic, Port Graham, and English Bay were the three communities that were defined by the board under its 81 subsistence regulations as being rural. And it was, you know, they picked those communities for several reasons. They were primarily native and they were inaccessible. The only access to these communities are by water or air. So the AFN, which was advocating its particular special interests at the time, urged that these communities be declared subsistence. Now, I must say on behalf of AFN that they did take another stance, and that was all the non-rural areas in the Cook Inlet, and in this particular case, non-native areas, the AFN urged that they be given personal use fisheries. But the problem with personal use fisheries is that it's not the same as a subsistence fishery. It does not have the same benefits as a subsistence fishery. The Board of Fishery pretty much established that fishery as an excess charity fishery. It would only operate at such times that commercial subsistence and sport needs were satisfied, plus there was no trade or barter involved in that fishery like there would be in a subsistence fishery. So there was some major...
I'd like to let the guest ask a question. Let Representative Phillips ask a question, and then Representative Gall, and if we could be brief on these questions. Representative Phillips?
Mr. Robinson, you may not know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I think last week or 2 weeks ago, we had a presentation from the Fisheries Committee about the Johnson-Dingle Act or funds. I think it's some $5 million, and there was another fund for $2 million. It was just the Robinson something or another act. $2 million seemed to be in jeopardy, and then there was an implication that the $5 million was also in jeopardy. Do you know anything about that?
Well, as I understand the presentation from the Attorney General's office about those funds being in jeopardy was that unless HB 288 was passed, that Alaska subsistence law would not be in compliance with federal law under ANILCA, thereby the federal government would be able to withhold certain monetary benefits from the state in these two funds unless this occurred. I understand that at least with regard to the larger of the two funds, the $5 million funds, that money is separate and distinct from any subsistence laws and that it's sort of a revenue sharing deal based on accessing sport fish licenses and so forth. So it seems to me that the federal government is mandated to pay that money regardless of what the situation is. But the main point, Representative Phillips, is that the legislative act that is on the books today is in compliance with ANILCA. There is no need to change the law to achieve that objective.
Representative Gall, if you could be brief.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Robinson, you made reference to limiting the means and numbers of fish caught and subsistence and so forth as a way to not create a competitive problem between this enlarged subsistence category and other user groups. Is that correct? Maybe you could describe for us how you think that the existing subsistence quotas have been established and why you think they can be reduced without creating the certain impression that subsistence uses are being limited for the benefit of the commercial and sport fisheries.
How they can be reduced?
Well, I'm saying to you, number one, there are quotas set at this time for subsistence use. What you're implying is that they can be reduced without impacting subsistence uses.
No, that's not what I'm implying, Representative Gall. What I'm saying is that they can either be maintained, increased, or reduced, depending on the circumstances of the stock.
No, and under the particular circumstance that you described, you said that if the stocks are being threatened, then they could develop two tiers among subsistence users only after the exclusion of other competition, when and only when the resource is being threatened. However, you said when the resource is not being threatened, the limitations on gear and times and so forth could be used to prevent an increased number of subsistence fishermen from unduly impacting the other user groups. In other words, you could limit subsistence harvests and in that way solve the problem. That's what you suggested to this committee.
Correct. You could.
Now, my question to you is, how do you think the existing quotas were set for subsistence, and why do you purport that they can be reduced without negatively impacting subsistence protection under federal law?
Okay, first of all, the reduction of quotas and bag limits in the past have been primarily done not necessarily with an intent to avoid impacting other users, but with the primary intent to avoid harmful impact on the resource. I mean,
that's not the circumstance we're talking about.
I know, but I'm just telling you.
Please go through the chair.
Pardon? But I'm just trying to deal with your question about reductions and why there are reductions. The Board of Fisheries on March 26th of this year has established quotas in the cook inlet salmon subsistence fishery at a number of 13,000 based on the highest number of salmon that has been harvested by that fishery. They also set a quota in the Copper River salmon fishery of 60,000, which was the high mark of that fishery. The reduction of quotas and bag limits, in my opinion, Representative Gall, should never be made strictly to allocate to the subsistence fishery in order to avoid impacting the other uses. If there is a reduction in bag limits and quotas, that reduction should be made, as the law would be required to be made, for the purpose of avoiding jeopardy and harm to the stocks involved in the fishery. So if you have a subsistence fishery now which has 60,000 quota in the Copper River, and the sport fishery, let's say, increased over there to the point that they were making more demands without really making any factual case that there was any harm to the stock, so therefore they needed to have their needs met, but that it was still an abundant situation, then I would think the boards would be out of line to reduce these bag limits just to take care of an unjustified and a demand that has no factual justification for it at all. So, yes, reductions can be made, but they should be made for conservation reasons, not for political demands on the part of user groups.
I'd like to close the questions down. I believe if there's any questions from the committee, we can ask Mr. Robinson to come back after Don Mitchell testifies. And could you tell us how long you'll be around town? Maybe other committee members could
I intend on leaving on the 5:35 flight tonight back to Kenai.
Okay. Maybe you could let our office know where you'll be, and we could have other people contact you.
Sure.
If they want to. Thank you. I have an announcement to make. If people could speak into their mic, the remote sites are having trouble picking up our transmission, and right now I'd like to call Mr. Don Mitchell to testify. If you could state your name and who you represent and explain to us what intervener means.
Good Thank you, Madam Chairman. Also, in terms of my timing, do you plan to adjourn the hearing at 10, or is it going to go longer? Or?
We have the teleconference till 9:55.
9:55. Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Donald Mitchell. I have represented in the past a variety of groups that have been involved actively in the subsistence hunting and fishing issue, including the Alaska Federation of Natives. I represented the native village of Tyonik in the litigation that Mr. Robinson mentioned earlier. I've been involved in most of the litigation associated with this issue since 1977, and I was actively involved representing the Alaska Federation of Natives during the congressional deliberations on the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act from 1977 to 1980, and consequently have some bit of personal knowledge of the requirements of Title VIII of that act with respect to this issue. With respect to who I'm representing this morning, I don't think that's altogether clear. I was invited down as an attorney who had been involved in the Madison case, and I'm not necessarily today representing anyone other than, I suppose, myself specifically, although I do continue to have attorney-client relationships with a number of the groups I've mentioned. What I would like to do this morning is to separate this issue basically into two piles. Pile number one is let's forget that there is a federal law, and let's just analyze the current situation on the basis of what is good public policy for Alaska. And after we're done with that, assuming we still have time, I would then like to analyze as a separate issue what the implications of the whole federal oversight and federal intervention aspect of this thing is. And as another preliminary matter, I'd like to say that on a personal note, that these are very difficult public policy issues, and I do not think it is helpful to characterize differences of opinion as misrepresentations and all that that implies. We have enough trouble in this state with these issues because they are so emotional, and the last thing that we need, I think, if we're all going to work this situation out, is to have people running around saying that there's bad faith going on in terms of how other people deal with their analysis of what the situation is. Now, with respect to the Madison case, I have no disagreement with many of the factual statements that Mr. Robinson has made in terms of the specific situation with Cook Inlet. I do take issue, however, with the legal conclusions that he draws with respect to what the implications are for the regulation of hunting and fishing in the state at this particular moment in time. And let me run through the drill very quickly for you, because I think there are a lot of self-evident truths about this issue that don't go on the record very often. First thing is that one of the reasons this issue is so confusing is that almost everywhere I go in the state, people think that they have some sort of right to hunt and fish, that commercial fishermen have some right to earn a livelihood, that anchored sport fishermen have a right to go down to the Kenai and catch a king salmon, that people who live out in villages have some kind of right to do this, that, or the other thing. The fact of the matter is that the Alaska Supreme Court has said clearly that no Alaskan has any right to do anything with respect to hunting and fishing. Basically, the responsibility for allocating the use of Alaska's fish and game resources in the Alaska Constitution is delegated not to the Board of Fisheries or Board of Game or to any user group with rights. It's delegated to you. Article 8 of the Alaska Constitution says that just like coal and oil and trees and all other natural resources, that it is the responsibility of the legislature to establish the rules for allocating access to those resources that in its judgment is in the best interest of all of the citizens of this state. Not that you cannot allocate specific resources to specific groups of citizens so long as you do it in a constitutional manner, but just that it's your responsibility and that these issues, just like allocating access to oil or natural gas, have very profound social and economic consequences. This is serious business. And I think the Alaska Constitution reflects that. That's the first thing. Second thing is that immediately upon Alaska becoming a state, the legislature basically abdicated that responsibility with respect to fish and game. It established a Fish and Game Board, delegated that Fish and Game Board all of your responsibility for this issue, and said, just go off and do whatever, quote, you deem advisable with respect to making these very serious social and economic decisions about hunting and fishing. Now, from statehood until the late 70s, the discretion that you delegated to first the Fish and Game Board and then later the separate Board of Fisheries and Board of Games was basically unfettered. They could do anything they wanted, subject only to some kind of vague constitutional limitation that when they juggled these decisions, they had to do so in a fair and reasonable manner. By the mid-1970s, rightly or wrongly, people who lived out in villages in the rural areas of the state concluded that in their judgment, they were not getting a fair shake as a result of the board's exercise of that absolutely unfettered discretion. That when they went in and told the boards about the importance of hunting and fishing for food to feed their families in those rural communities, that they did not have the political punch on the board to basically get a fair shake. Now, I'm not prepared to debate whether that was right or wrong. I'm just prepared to say that that was their perception. Now, as the result of that, in 1978, the Alaska legislature enacted the Alaska Subsistence Law, and in 1980, as part of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, the United States Congress enacted Title VIII of ANILCA. And basically, the intent of both of those laws was to, well, particularly the state law, was to take back that unfettered discretion that you had given those boards and to give it some very clear marching orders. Now, up until the Madison decision, the policy assumption was that hunting and fishing is so important to the economy of those rural communities that if there are situations in which there is not enough of a particular game population or fish stock to go around for all user groups, that it is good state public policy to provide those folks out there who are hunting and fishing basically to feed themselves and to maintain the integrity of those rural communities as economic units, to provide them with some leg up. Now, we were all around when that public policy issue was debated during the 1982 referendum on repealing the state subsistence law, and it's obviously reasonable minds can differ. You don't necessarily have to agree with that. I personally agree with that. Obviously, most of my clients agree with that. But the point is that when we had that statewide debate in 1982, I don't think that anybody, when they went into that voting booth, thought that what they were not voting on was whether or not it was good public policy in this state to have folks that live out in villages to have a special leg up in times when they needed it if you had to make difficult allocation decisions. Those were the rules until Madison. Now, what the Madison case says is that that assumption on all of our part was incorrect. And without debating the Supreme Court, the fact of the matter is they have the ability to decide what the legislature's intent was, and they have decided. What they have decided is that every Alaskan resident who hunts and fish in order to eat it, as a matter of law, is a subsistence, engaged in a subsistence use, and those persons' reasonable needs cannot be restricted in terms of the amount of a game population or fish stock they can take until such time as all other uses have been eliminated. Now, on this particular point, obviously, Mr. Robinson and I have a very profound intellectual disagreement, and you're going to have to decide for yourselves. I would suggest, however, that if you look at, I assume that the copy of the Madison decision is in your packet, and if you look on pages 17 and also pages 16 of that decision, you will find that there are criteria that the court has set down, particularly on page 17, that are unrelated to biology. Let's start again with the assumption that under the Madison decision, everybody in the fishery who fishes with a net for personal use as a matter of law is now engaged, according to the Alaska Supreme Court, in a subsistence use. At what point in time can you, can the Board of Fisheries go down to the so-called Tier 2 and start allocating access based upon the three criteria of local residency, availability of alternative resources, and economic dependence? And if you look at the first paragraph on page 17, the court tells you. It doesn't suggest, it tells. It says that in order to go from Tier 1 to Tier 2, quote, the board, it must find, one, that it is necessary to restrict the taking of fish for sustained yield purposes, which it always is, because obviously if any fish stock was sufficient to satisfy all user groups, nobody would care. It would just be open and we'd all just go fishing and that would be great. So you're always in a situation where you got to restrict the fishery for sustained yield purposes. And two, that eliminating sport and commercial uses will not assure the maintenance of fish stocks on a sustained yield basis. That is implying to me that the court is saying that you can't go from Tier 1 to Tier 2 without eliminating sport and commercial uses. Obviously, Mr. Robinson disagrees. I leave it to you to decide for yourself, because you're the folks that are going to have to make a cut on this legislation, what the Supreme Court has said. Now, if you go back to page 16, you'll find that on the last sentence of that first long paragraph, you'll see that if the statutory priority given to all subsistence users over commercial and sport users still results in too few fish for all subsistence uses, then the board is authorized to establish a second tier for preferred subsistence users based upon the three criteria. Now, the reason that there has been so much commotion about this issue is that if the Board of Fisheries is to obey the Madison decision, there are going to be profound reallocations of sport and commercial fisheries in order to comply with this decision. Now, Mr. Robinson said, well, the Board of Fisheries before it adjourned passed a resolution and put an artificial cap on these subsistence fisheries, and therefore everything is okay. I assume that that resolution is in your packet. If you read it, that's not what the Board of Fisheries said. What the Board of Fisheries said is there are going to have to be a complete retooling of these fishing regulations, but we do not have the courage or the time to do it this fishing season. So therefore, even though the Supreme Court has told us what the law is, we choose not to obey it this year. Not that it's going to go away, but just that we choose not to obey it this year, and we're just going to cap these things off at an artificial level, and we'll worry about it later, assuming that this situation doesn't get fixed. Now, let's look at how that might work. In Tyonek, prior to this decision, you had a king run that went by that village, and because you could limit the participation in that subsistence fishery just to folks who live there, each household was given a household allocation of what was reasonable for folks to take, and basically the fish went by. They took their household allocation. The total of that household allocation was, I think when you totaled it up, it was like 3,000 to 4,200 fish based upon how you wanted to count it. And then the rest of the fish, the majority of that run, went up the Susitna River drainage, where it was harvested not by subsistence fishermen, but by a very large and important recreational sport fishery for Anchorage folks. And you all know what goes on up there, and it's great. You know, there's fishing lodges, there's people running around in airboats. It's a major recreational resource. And it worked out great, because the people down in the village at the front end of the run got their run, and everybody else was okay. Under this current situation, what the Board of Fisheries has had to do is to open up that fishery to any Alaskan that wants to be there. But they've put an artificial cap on it. So if 20,000 people, I mean, I'm obviously being facetious, but in terms of the intellectual analysis, I'm not. If 20,000 people come over there and put a net out on that beach, assuming that there are no access problems with that, then according to what the Board of Fisheries has done, as soon as they hit 4,200 fish, the fishery is closed and the rest of the fish go up to the sport fishermen, even if the people in that village only catch two fish. Now,
Mitchell, mm-hmm. If you could wind down, then I'll take questions from the committee members.
So the point is that what lawyers do is it's easy to tell you what the past is. What we really get paid to do is to predict the future, like a gypsy woman with a crystal ball. I can guarantee you that that kind of a situation at some point is going to be litigated. And I think that the Board of Fisheries has admitted in that resolution that they do not have a leg to stand on, and unless this thing gets fixed, there are going to be those kinds of reallocations, and that's obviously why in addition to the rural community, the sport and the commercial fishing community, and the Department of Law, and the Commissioner of Fish and Game, who has constitutional responsibility for these issues, has urged you to pass this legislation.
Okay, I have a question, if you could respond briefly to this one. Is I believe Mr. Robinson said that he believes that we are in compliance with ANILCA, that the state is already in compliance. Could you give me your interpretation of that and, you know, what you think there?
Sure. Setting aside for a moment the purview of federal jurisdiction on these issues, because that's a separate legal question, but just in terms of compliance, the terms and conditions that the state must meet are set out in Section 805 of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. You will see, as part of those requirements, I assume that that's probably not a part of your packet, but if it's not, you certainly should review that statute before you conclude so nonchalantly that everything is great with the federal government. What among the other requirements that the state has got to prove to the federal government is that it has a statute which provides a priority for subsistence uses, which you still do, obviously. You have a priority statute, so you're okay there. But you also, as a separate requirement, must prove to the federal government that you have a statute which defines the term, quote, subsistence uses, close quote, in a manner consistent with the same term of art in the federal statute, which is Section 803 of ANILCA. Now, if you compare the two statutes, you have a statutory definition of subsistence uses, the federal government has a statutory definition of subsistence uses. On its face, the federal government's definition is limited to folks that live out in rural areas of the state. As the result of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the same term in Madison, you no longer do. Now, I don't want to get into a debate about this, but just to make sure that I was on firm ground, I phoned yesterday afternoon my sources both in the Office of the Secretary of the Interior and in the Office of the Solicitor, and they both informed me, obviously there's been no request for a formal decision, but they both informed me that in their judgment, yes, the state is not in compliance with ANILCA. Now, with respect to Mr. Horn and the first time around the block, that was basically a political situation. One of the reasons that that rural people did not trust the Department of the Interior was precisely because of the kind of shenanigans that Mr. Horn engaged in the first time around with respect to ensuring that the state government was going to do the right thing. That is why there is another section of ANILCA, which is Section 807, which says that you do not need to rely upon the Department of the Interior to enforce the federal rules. Any aggrieved person, whether they be Tionic, whose fishery will be overrun by folks basically stealing fish from the sport fishery up the river, or any other group of aggrieved folks that live out in the villages as a result of this decision, right now can go in front of Judge Vonderheid and within probably 2 weeks get a federal court order mandating certain decisions to be made on the basis of the federal statute. That is a very serious problem, independent of the $1 million worth of ANILCA funds that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is going to lose because they're not in compliance with the federal statute.
Representative Schultz.
Okay, if I may, but getting back to Vanderheide's going to make that decision, he'd have to make the decision based on his interpretation of what is rural. Is that?
No. What,
okay, we have in the legislature in statute several definitions of the word rural based on loan programs, et cetera. Right? So what is a rural resident of the state? And it doesn't specify that in the bill.
Right. With all due respect, Representative Schultz, that is not the issue that Judge Vonderheit would rule on. He would rule on the narrow issue of whether or not the state statutory definition of subsistence uses is in fact consistent with Section 803 of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. What is rural is it's an interesting and provocative intellectual and legal question, but it is not relevant in my legal judgment to whether or not the state is or is not in compliance with the mandates of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
Well, Okay, it's, if I may follow up. Okay, it's relevant. It's relevant to me because of the bill that's before us, 288, and when we speak to the word rural, if we don't speak to it, then we're going to leave the interpretation to the board to be able to tell us. And I have a feeling that depending on what definition they would want to accept as rural, I could see communities like Dot Lake, Chicken, wherever, being eliminated from rural.
Well, there are two ways to do that, as I'm sure you know better than I. One way, of course, is for the legislature to attempt to define that term. Another way to do it is to delegate responsibility to the boards to adopt a regulation which does so. Now, I would suggest my personal recommendation, although you haven't asked me for it, is that these are very difficult factual questions, and I think you'd be better off delegating the situation to the board. Now, obviously, we can all agree that Eagle or Kosigluk or Togiak is probably a rural area of the state in which hunting and fishing for personal and family use is a significant component of the local economy. We can probably also conclude that Anchorage and Fairbanks is not such an area. Obviously, I would like to go hunting and fishing. If I can't go, there's going to be no major damage to the economy of downtown Anchorage where I live. Now, the trouble becomes, what happens when you, that's clean at the ends of the policy, what happens in the middle? Is the Kenai Peninsula more like Togiak than it is like Anchorage? Is Bethel or Nome more like Anchorage than it is like Togiak? Those are very difficult factual issues, and generally, not only with the Board of Fish and Game, but with all regulatory agencies, the reason that the legislature has established them is because you folks have enough things to worry about just setting basic policy without attempting to apply those policies to very convoluted factual patterns.
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, let me follow up. But that's my fear. If we turn that over, that decision of defining rural over to the board and don't make the definition ourselves, that we have one on the books now that simply says that any community that's connected by a road is considered rural or considered urban. So that means that, you know, every community in my district, for example, is considered urban.
Right. Well, all I'm saying again is that is the legislature's business, not mine. You can do it any way that, in your judgment, you think it should be done. But the point is that is a separate issue from the issue of whether or not the state is now in compliance with the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, and it is a separate issue as to whether or not, if the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game actually implements the Madison decision, there are going to be some massive reallocations of hunting and fishing opportunities that were not necessary to reallocate prior to the issuing of the court's decision. And that's obviously why the Governor and Commissioner Collinsworth are so concerned about this issue.
We're running out of time, and I'd like to take other questions from committee members. Any other questions from committee members? If not, I'd like to now take questions from guests. Representative Fuller.
Thank you. I thought I was going Mr. Mitchell, if we were determined to not be in compliance, would the federal intervention come as a result of a legal challenge, or would the federals just take over?
Well, I think the answer is both, and I have not, because we're not at that point yet, there is no one who I think wants that result, and so there has not been really, I have not done the kind of legal analysis of the situation that should be done to really give you a definitive answer to that question. I would say, just off the top of my head, that there are two ways that it could happen. One way would be the federal government coming in and saying, basically, we certified the state to begin with because the state said that its definition of subsistence uses was limited just to folks out there in rural communities. That turns out to have been a misstatement of fact on the part of the state of Alaska going into this thing, because the Supreme Court has interpreted your definition of that term differently. Therefore, we, the federal government, have a responsibility to intervene. That's one way it could occur. Second way it could occur is the federal government says, yeah, we agree with all of that, but this is a too hot an issue, and if there's any way that we can wiggle out of it, we would like this whole thing to just go away, at which point in time, that's exactly why Section 807 was included in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, to allow aggrieved Alaskans to be able to seek the support of the judicial system to mandate that result. So it could come in one of two ways. Now, what the federal government would do is a separate issue, whatever it would be. Again, I'm not really prepared to address with any absolute certainty how that would work, but I can guarantee you that it would be unpleasant and it would certainly be disruptive, and the most tragic part about it is that, in my judgment, it's obviously completely unnecessary.
Okay, we're out of time. I'm going to have to adjourn here. I'd like to thank Mr. Mitchell and Mr. Robinson, and I'd also like to thank you, Mr. Freeman, for being online. And at this time, no further business to come before the House Research Committee. I'll adjourn the meeting.
Sure. When you were talking about, that was my next question. My next question was, you said that there would be profound, and I know that the game board or the fish board has come out and said that there will be profound allocation changes made. My question is.